Welcome, everybody, to a wonderful Erev Shabbos, Parshas Vayishlach of Tav Shin Ayin. That's 5770. And we are getting very close to Hanukkah. Next Shabbos is going to be Shabbos of Hanukkah. That means Hanukkah begins next Friday night.
Right.
So that's wonderful. My class today has nothing to do, at least openly, with Hanukkah. I'm just mentioning that because it's exciting. Also, just as a good time to make a quick halachic reminder, beginning on Saturday night, tomorrow evening, we will insert the special words for the winter. The same Talu Matar Livracha. Grant dew and rain for blessing, which is only in the weekday version of the prayer of the Amidah, but it begins Saturday night. It would have begun tonight because it's December the 4th, but since it's Shabbos, we don't say those blessings. But from now on, starting Saturday night and until Pesach, all of our weekday prayers should have that insert.
What about the service that come in between now and Pesach? You don't play on that anymore?
Well, there is no weekday prayer. So.
No. Oh, yeah, okay, that's right.
Anyway, getting back to the Parsha. Not getting back to the Parsha, getting to the Parsha. I also would like to reiterate, since we're still young in the year, that we are studying this year the concepts related to tefillah, to prayer. And we're relying very heavily on Sha'arim B'Tfilah, a book written in Hebrew by Rabbi Shimshon Pinkus, of blessed memory. Well, one of the terms which we find in the Midrash of our sages for that it's used for prayer is kriya, calling. Calling. Hello, hello. We call out to Hashem in prayer. And I would like to meditate a little bit with you on the term kriya, calling. And I would also like to relate it to some, I find, interesting notes in the Parsha. And also get a little bit more of a handle on a deep concept, and a fundamental concept in Judaism called bitachon, or trust in Hashem. Because all of these things are related somehow together.
I thought that kriya was the sharing when they morning.
Don't interrupt the rabbi, yeah. Please.
That's a different spelling, a different word.
Oh.
All right. Let's meditate for a bit on the notion of calling. Let's say I call out to someone. Abba. That's Hebrew for Dad, Father, or Ima, or Yossi, I'm calling out to somebody. When I'm calling out to somebody by name, let's assume for a moment that there are three ingredients to my calling. Ingredient number one, I need something. Ingredient number two, I believe that the person that I'm calling can help me with what I need. It might be a question. It may be something I need help. Maybe I'm drowning. God forbid. I'm calling that person because I believe that that person can help. And number three, I believe that that person hears me calling him. Or at least I hope that he'll hear me. I believe that if you might agree that if any of those three ingredients were lacking, I probably wouldn't be calling. Right? If I didn't need anything, I wouldn't call him. If I didn't think he could help me, I wouldn't call him. If I need something, I'm going to call someone that can help me. I'm not going to call someone that can help. And if they can't hear me, I'm not going to call him either, because it'll be futile. So, just at the very, very elementary level, if tefillah, prayer, is calling to Hashem, then it would seem reasonable that these three ingredients should be present to make this form of tefillah, or maybe it's even a preface to tefillah, meaningful. So let's ask ourselves, next time we sit down or stand up to pray to Hashem and to call Him, let's ask ourselves these three lead questions. A, do I need something? B, do I believe that He can help? And C, do I think He's listening? If we don't have them, then calls into question our tefillah. Is it really a bona fide prayer? And if you think about it a little further, if we analyze and meditate on this a little bit more, I believe that these three questions are not independent questions, but they're dependent questions, interdependent questions. For example, let's say I'm soul searching and I ask myself, when I'm praying to God, do I need something? Do I think He can help? And do I think He's listening? I might doubt some of those, because let's say that I say to myself, I don't know. I don't know if He can help me. I don't know if He's listening, because I've never had the experience. I don't know. Now, there's only one thing, one of those three, that I really can decide for myself, that's really dependent on me. And that is the first question, do I need something? If I've ever needed something, underline over the word if, under the word. If I ever needed something, and I called out to God, and He helped me, then I know the answer to all three questions. Because I needed something, I called to Him, He heard me, and He helped me. But that's a big if. If I've never needed anything, then I can be unsure about the other two questions. Because I don't know if He heard me, because I never really needed anything. And I don't know if He could have helped me, because I never needed anything. So it seems like in order to set the ball of tefillah into motion, we really have to start off with the first question. And that is something which is totally dependent on ourselves. Do we need something? And that is a very, very important question that cannot be underestimated. Let's pause for a minute from all of our philosophical inquiries and take a look at the Parsha. A couple of interesting observations. One of them I've shared with you before, and one of them which is brand new. It's brand new for me, and it's brand new for my presentation of the Parsha. The one that I've shared before numerous times is a scene at the beginning of the Parsha. The Parsha opens up with Yaakov sending messengers ahead to communicate with Esav, his brother. Yaakov has been away in Haran for 20 years. He's been dealing with Laban, his father-in-law. He's been creating his family. And now he's on the way back to the land of Israel, and he hears that Esav, his brother, who sought his destruction 20 years ago, is coming to greet him with a whole army. So he prepares, I'm kind of quoting Rashi in summary, he prepares for this encounter in three ways. He prepares militarily, strategically. He sends Esav a peace offering made up of many different animals, and he prays to Hashem. But the Torah is very clear how Yaakov was feeling at that time as he prepared for this encounter. in verse 8, chapter 32, it states, Vayira Yaakov Me'od Vayetzer Lo. Yaakov became very frightened and it distressed him. Two words, two descriptive words of his emotions. Fear, Me'od. Whenever you see the word Me'od in the Torah, it's a lot, excessive. And I don't mean more than enough. It's abundant. And Vayetzer, distress, like tzaras. The word tzaras comes from this word. Same root. Yaakov had a lot of tzaras. And then he prepared. And, you know, it's striking for the Torah to say that about Yaakov, because we know that Yaakov is a great, great man, great tzaddik, great patriarch. He has undergone so many trials and ordeals, and Hashem has been with him. Hashem told him that he would be with him. And to hear the expression that Yaakov was very frightened seems uncharacteristic. Sounds like he's losing it. And Rashi kind of assuages our concern about this by saying that he was afraid that he may have used up all of his merits and all of the previous events, and maybe there was not so much left in the bank account. But it still begs the question, why was Yaakov so afraid? So I want to leave that for now, just to raise that question and come back to it. Now, the part that is new, when I was reading in the book Sha'arim B'Tfilah this week about Kriya, about calling, I was looking to see if there was any calling out to Hashem in the Parsha, and I didn't find calling out to Hashem, but I did find the word calling three times, and they were all very similar. It's Yaakov calling a place where he had a certain experience by a certain name of God. And I'm going to show you those three right in Vayishlach. I never noticed them. It was striking that there are three that are so similar. The first one, same chapter, chapter 33, verse 20. This is page 180. As Yaakov comes through that encounter with Esav safely. The Torah says, really backing up to verse 18 on that page, Yaakov arrived intact. Intact means even after he... Wait a minute. Is this after the encounter? Yes, after the encounter. There was also the encounter with the angel, but this is after everything. So he came back intact at the city of Shechem in the land of Canaan upon his arriving from Padan Aram, that's where Laban lived, and he encamped before the city. He bought the parcel of land upon which he pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 kesitas. And then it says in verse 20, Vayatzev shom at Mizbeach, Vayikra lo Kel Elokei Yisrael. He set up an altar there and pronounced and proclaimed, God, the God of Israel. Vayikra, that's the verb he called. He made a proclamation, God, the God of Israel. Kael, one of the names of God, means usually powerful, God of Israel. It's funny because he wasn't called Yisrael yet. His name was changed to Yisrael later. Mm-hmm. But I guess he knew it, so... Oh, I know, because the angel told him that it was going to be changed. All right. So he already knew about the name. Anyway, it's interesting. He's at a place. He's arrived safely. He builds an altar, and he calls it, or he proclaims, according to our scroll, he didn't call the Mizbeach, the altar, that name. He proclaimed that over the altar. But to make a blessing over a cup of wine, he made a proclamation of God over the altar. Second incident, second calling, happens in chapter 35, verse 7. And this occurs after he has moved from Shechem. There was an ordeal that happened with his daughter. Dina was abducted. So after that incident, he comes now to Beis El. If you remember, Beis El was the place where he had his dream. All the temples and shuls that are called Bethel, get it from here. And that's where he discovered was the gateway to heaven. So when he arrives there, he was also survived, you know, a horrific ordeal with his daughter. It also says there, verse 7, Vayiven Sham Mizbeach, he built an altar there. Vayikra Lamokom Kael Beis El. English says El Bethel. For it was there that God had been revealed to him during his flight from his brother. Because he realized there he was where he had been 20 years ago. God revealed himself to him. It was the place of Beis El. El Beis El, God revealed himself in Beis El. Again, a proclamation, Vayikra. The third incident, where he calls the place, is the very next page. 35, 14, and 15. This is after Hashem appears to him and blesses him and informs him that, in fact, his name will be changed to Yisrael. And he also says, I'm going to make you a great nation. Kings will emerge from you. I will give you the land that I promised to your fathers. Vayatsev Yaakov Matseva b'makom asher diber ito matseves aven. Vayikra Yaakov es shem ha-makom asher diber ito sham Elohim Beis El. Jacob set up a pillar where God had spoken. Then Jacob called the name of the place where God had spoken with him, Beis El. Another calling, another proclamation of the place. So, I think this is interesting. There seems to be a pattern. He seems to have this habit of when things happen to him, he builds an altar and he makes this proclamation which has something to do with God's names and various combinations of his names. It's just something that can't be ignored. It's got to be significant. So, my question is, what is the meaning of that? Okay, those are the two references to the Parsha. Let us now talk a little bit about the third topic I mentioned, which is Bitachon, trust in God, and then come back and address the two Parsha issues and also the idea of calling God in prayer. I want to read to you a paragraph, an entire paragraph from this book. If you're like me, you will be impressed. There is a concept in Jewish tradition called bitachon, trusting in God. Trusting in God is, on one hand, an obligation, something that we're supposed to do, even though it's difficult. There's a man in this community that told me that to him that's the most difficult mitzvah of all, to trust in God. But not only is it an obligation, but it's also a benefit. In other words, the concept of bitachon states that if a person does bitachon right, if he trusts in God, then God will indeed help him. And it's almost like, you know, like a money back guarantee kind of thing. So it's a very exciting prospect. But I want to read to you what Rabbi Pinkus quotes from the famous Brisker Rav, that was Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik of blessed memory, who was one of the leading rabbis in Israel, probably in the 50s, 60s, something like that. Came from Europe. His father was the great Rav Chaim Soloveitchik of Europe. And he's an uncle of the of the Rav Soloveitchik from YU, from New York and Boston. Anyways, it's a dynasty of a family. He used to say the following principle, the following very, very fundamental point about bitachon. This midah, this quality, whereby a man trusts in God and is thus saved from his troubles, we can only say...
Oh, boy. Sorry.
Okay.
Oh,
don't worry. Come back when you're done. Nucha lo marzos. Let me read the Hebrew, too, because the Hebrew is beautiful. Midazu, this quality, the Adam Haboteach Bashem, that a man who trusts in God, Nitzal Mitzaraso, is saved from his distress. Nuchalo Marzos, we are able to say this, Rak Kaasher Hu Makir, only when he recognizes the Godel Hatzara, the significance, the severity of the distress. V'yodea ad kama gedola sakanaso, and he knows just how great a danger he is in. U'b'chol zos boteach b'Hashem, and in spite of the great danger, despite of his full awareness of the great danger, he is trusting God, shiyoshiyo, that he will save him, v'yatzilo, and Hashem saves him in response to that trust. Rak az yuchal lihikore boteach b'Hashem, and only then can he be called someone who trusts in God. That is a complete trust. And indeed he will be saved in the merit of that trust. But if he does not assess the significance, the severity of the distress, and he doesn't have a natural fear of it, uboteach, and consequently he doesn't trust because he doesn't feel in danger, lo yikorezos boteach b'Hashem, he cannot be called one who trusts in Hashem. The ma'ase eno yorei, because the fact that he's not fearing, the samuch libo batuach, but rather he feels confident, his heart is at ease, Shie lo tov, he feels that everything's going to be good. Hu mipnei she'enu yodea godel tzaraso. That is only because he doesn't realize how great of his distress is. So he feels calm, he feels assured. That's not trusting in God. That's ignorance of his situation. Lo shu boteach v'someich al HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's not saying that he is reliant and dependent upon Hashem. V'im kein ein zeh bitachon. That cannot be called bitachon. V'kevin shekein, and since it's not really bitachon, memela eino muchrach sheyinotzel mi'asakana. There therefore is no guarantee that he's going to be saved from the danger, because he doesn't feel that he's in danger. And therefore he doesn't really trust in God. And since he's not trusting in God, God is not going to protect him, even though the danger is real, in fact, in reality, it is real. But since the person is unaware of it, and therefore he doesn't really depend on Hashem, he doesn't have that assurance that Hashem will protect him. Avol kasher yodea umakir godel hatzara shenim tzabah. But when a person knows and recognizes full well the severity, the extent of the distress that he is in, the yodea shehakadosh baruch hu barachamav yachol lahatzilo ulishomro, and he knows that God, in His mercy, will and can and will save him and protect him, uboteach bo, and he truly is reliant on Him, oz nikra boteach bo yisparach. Then this person is called a boteach, a truster of God. The oz be'emes yishmerehu, and then God will actually protect him in response to his trust. Pretty amazing, huh? What do you think, Yaakov? Going back to our first our three questions. If I'm calling someone, that means A, I know I need them. I know that I need something from them that I can't get by myself. B, I know that they can help me. C, I know they're listening. That's a full cycle. Let's think if we have that cycle with God. I'm calling to God. Do I think I need something? That's the biggie. That is the biggie. In fact, my son is here visiting. He came with his wife, who's came to participate in the shiva for her grandmother. He just told me, I shared with him a little bit about what we're going to talk about in our class, and he said that he once attended a lecture when he was in Israel a couple years ago, and the whole point of this lecture was that our biggest problem, the biggest challenge that we have today in prayer is not that we don't understand the words or that we don't, can't say the Hebrew. It's that we don't feel that we need God. And we all know various different contexts that we've discussed this many times, that we live in a world of illusion, and particularly we live in a time and a place where we have reasons and answers and solutions for everything. If it's an illness, we have a cure. If it's a social problem, we have an explanation, and many times we have an excuse. Don't blame so and so because he is subject to the accident of birth or whatever. We have reasons for everything, rationalizations for everything. And the more we explain everything, and let's focus on fears, the more we think we have the solution, the less we feel that we're dependent, and certainly we are not going to develop a trust in God, because we never had item number one. We never had a feeling of a need for him. We may have had a need, but we thought that we didn't need God because we had a solution. You know, like the funny story I've told you about the parking spot. The guy that doesn't have the parking spot, he needs to get to his meeting, and he says, God, please give me a parking spot, and then I will, devote my life to you. And then all of a sudden, a car pulls out, and he says, never mind, God, I found one. And we're constantly doing that. Anytime there's a need, we fill it by something that doesn't require God. If it's an illness, we fill the need by medicine. Anyways, it's a difficult thing. So if a person goes around and says, don't worry, everything's going to be okay, be happy, it may be that that person trusts in God, but it may be that that person just doesn't realize the situation, and they're just deluding themselves into thinking that there's no danger. And we realize that without these three ingredients, we can't really call out to God, because we don't really need him. We don't feel we need him. Well, anyways, getting back to Yaakov, I think it's beautiful. Vayira Yaakov me'od v'yetzer lo. Yaakov was extremely frightened, and it was distressed him. And then he went on preparing for his encounter with Esav, very coolly, very calculated, with tefillah, prayer, and strategy, and present. Why does it say that? It's not because he was a scaredy cat. No, he had divested himself from any illusion that he was not dependent on God. He recognized, he acknowledged full well the severity, the danger. He knew that without God's help, Esav would literally pulverize him. You missed the part when I quoted you. He knew that Esav was going to pulverize him without God's help. He knew that without God's help, he is his entire future, the entire destiny of the Jewish people was going to be undermined. You, Rama, oh, do you have to say goodbye?
No, I just stopped by and say hi to everybody here.
Oh. Thank you.
Hello, and goodbye.
Really?
Yes,
we will. Oh, you're going to visit Teddy. Okay. It's because he recognized the danger. That's why he was such a boteach b'Hashem. He was such a truster in God. And because he was such a truster in God, God saved him. It's beautiful. He didn't have answers. He didn't have the solutions. He says, I am totally in predicament. I can't do anything about it without God's help. I mean, there are things I can do, but with God's help. So he went ahead and he did the things he could do. He prepared strategically. We've talked about before the balance of hishtadlus. Even with bitachon, even a person who has complete bitachon also is engaged in hishtadlus, in human effort, up to the best of his ability. But even he realizes that the human effort is not going to be the solution. It's only a mitzvah. It's only something that he's obligated to do because God has empowered him to do that. And so he does it. But he knows that's not the solution. He knows that that does not guarantee his success. Only God guarantees his success. A person that goes to work knows, a totally Jewish mind knows, I've got to go to work, but my parnasa, my sustenance, comes from Hashem. My going to work is my duty, my obligation. It's not my means of control. It's not my means of taking matters into my own hands. A Jewish doctor knows, one who reads Maimonides' Creed, he knows that his duty, his empowerment, is to perform the medical procedure, but that the outcome is in God's hands. When my father-in-law had open-heart surgery, he was so moved when the doctor, who was a Jew, but not an observant Jew, per se, he told him, before I go into surgery, I say a prayer. I can't tell you how my father-in-law was comforted by that. Yaakov is teaching us that in order to really be called Boteach b'Hashem, you have to realize the danger. And this is, according to this one scholar in Jerusalem, this is our greatest challenge today. Going back to the naming of the places, perhaps we can answer and explain that along the same lines. Yaakov Avinu knew that spiritual growth in Judaism, in relationship with God, is to become more and more aware of God's omnipotence and his involvement in his life. In other words, every time Yaakov encountered some dangerous situation, he used it as an opportunity to come, get in touch with his situation, realize the danger, realize his vulnerability, and realize the greater omnipotence of God, and become stronger in that bitachon. So every time he underwent an ordeal, he put an altar there, and he said, Hashem is even greater than I thought he was, because I was even in a greater danger, and he came through and he saved me. I've got to make a proclamation. I've got to put a mile marker that say, Hashem is even greater, and my reliance on him is even greater than it was before. The next ordeal, once again, I recognize, I don't deny it, I recognize the danger, and I celebrate my awareness that God's power is even greater than I thought. There was a story once of Rav Sadia Gaon, one of the Gaonim of the, even before Rashi, and he was once asked by a simple Jew, do you say the entire Amidah every day? And he said, why, certainly. He says, do you say the prayer, forgive me, God, for I have sinned? He said, yes, I do. That's part of the Amidah. He says, Rabbi, you're such a tzaddik, such a saint. You mean you sin every day? Aren't you lying when you say that? Forgive me, God, for I have sinned. You don't sin. Come on. He says, oh, I do, absolutely. He says, what do you sin? He says, every day I recognize more and more what God can do. And I look back at yesterday, and I said, boy, yesterday I underestimated the power of Hashem. And for that I ask for forgiveness, for underestimating Hashem's power. But that requires first and foremost, a recognition of our vulnerability and how we are in need. If we walk around in denial and this cloud of everything's hunky-dory and yihyeh tov, it'll be good just because we tell ourselves it will be good, we are not developing our bitachon nafos. So this is a lesson. So the key, tying it back to tefillah, the measure of our tefillah is the way we call him. It all starts from the kriya. It all starts from the way. Abba, Hashem, I'm about to pray to you, but listen to how I'm calling you. I'm calling you because I have needs, because I acknowledge that I have needs, not hiding it, and because I have needs, I learn that you listen to me, and I learn that I can trust in you, and you answer me. And that's the measure of our tefillah, the way we call him, the kriya. Thank you.
What I'm hearing you say is that Yaakov's fear was not an expression of his own frailty or, God forbid, arrogance, his fear, but rather that God put the fear in him to remind him of God's presence.
Well,
it was a way in which it was a tool that God used to remind Yaakov that he should rely on God and not on himself. I mean, fear can arise also because we rely on ourselves, but what I'm hearing is you're saying Yaakov was not arrogant, thinking that he could conquer Esau, mm-hmm. and therefore he was fearful that he might die. Rather, it was God that put the fear inside of him.
Well, I didn't mean to say that God put it into him. I'm saying that it's a question, it's a matter of choice that Yaakov chose to see his situation for what it really was, and not to try to minimize the danger.
But isn't it possible that God put the fear in him to remind him?
What?
Isn't it possible that God put the fear in him at that moment?
I mean, fear is something that that's a human emotion, and the human, it's part of our free choice. We can decide to be fearful. We can decide to not be fearful.
Sometimes yes, it's an involuntary response.
Well, that's what we have to work on. In other words, if a person doesn't feel fear, it may be because he is living under delusion. Why does he do that? Because maybe it's a defense mechanism. People who really... Listen, if you don't have a solution and you also don't trust in God, then you feel that you're being choked. So the only thing you can do is escape. And the way we escape is we create delusions for ourselves. And what I'm saying is Yaakov, the Ish Emes, the man of truth, he did not live under delusion. And he acknowledged the severity of his situation. He said, I'm right now coming to encounter a man that can kill me. Now, I'm not going to stop there. That's my step one. My step two is that there's a God in the world, and God has empowered me with a mind to be able to take measures such as the strategy and as the gift that I can try to placate him, Esav. And he's also promised me that if I trust in him, he will help me. So therefore he allowed himself to fully appreciate the fear, and then to deal with it, and then to go on and conquer the fear. So it's not a weakness that he had the fear. That's kind of what I was thinking at the beginning. You know, why is Yaakov afraid? Because he was going through step one. The only way to truly develop trust in God is to acknowledge the fear for what it really is, and not to try to delude oneself.
On the other hand, I'm not going to monopolize. On the other hand, I think you could argue that if he was really relying on God to begin with, the fear would not have been there at all.
But that's a delusion. Fear means, for example, I ride on an airplane, okay? Now, I could go on that airplane and feel calm, but I would be an idiot if I would walk onto that airplane and not be aware that I am 30,000 feet above the earth, and if something goes wrong, that could be the end of me. If I go into an airplane not realizing that that is the situation, then I'm an idiot. I'm fooling myself. I can go in, and I could say, I've taken all the precautions, including, I'm saying a religious person, a God-fearing person says, first of all, God has not prohibited me from doing this. If I do something which is considered to be dangerous, I'm in violation of a mitzvah. I'm not allowed to go tightrope walking over the Grand Canyon and say, I have complete faith in God that he will save me. No, God would probably say, you're not allowed to do that. All right? Going in an airplane is considered to be normative behavior. I'm allowed to do that. I have permission from God. Number two, I've taken all the precautions. I'm flying on a reputable airline, right? And the FAA has very, very strict guidelines, and I know that, and I'm aware of that as I come in. I've made my choice, and the statistics, you know, this, that, and the other. And I trust in God. So now I can walk onto the airplane, and I can be calm. But I can't walk onto the airplane and say to somebody, it's nothing. Being on an airplane, that's nothing. You can't say that's nothing. You're an idiot. If a person, goes and applies for a job and gets a job and says, that was nothing. He's deluding himself. It's not nothing. There are many, many people that don't have jobs. So you have to say, it's a very big sakana, it's a very big danger, and I have no control, and my goodness, Hashem was good to me, and I trust him for that. But you can delude, a person can delude himself to thinking it was nothing.
Shkoach.
Next time we meet, it will be Erev Chanukah. Yeah. God willing.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.